Professor McGowan for a very kind invitation, and I consider it a huge privilege to be able to come and deliver this F.F. Bruce lecture in 2006. One of my abiding disappointments is that I never met F.F. Bruce. There was one opportunity, I think, that I might have been able to take to listen to F.F. Bruce before he died, and it was, I think, in my first year, possibly even the first term as an undergraduate. And for various reasons, it wasn't possible for me to attend that, or I didn't make it a high enough priority, and the opportunity never came again. However, in my office at the university, Andrew, I think you've sat in a chair that used to be in F.F. Bruce's office, his study at Buxton. And I was given by his widow a set of word biblical commentaries from that study in his house in Buxton. And I have in my own house a few small bookshelves that were scattered around, whole collections of them scattered around his house in Buxton, with a private library in his house of some 10,000 volumes that his wife was desperate to get rid of. And she was all for getting a skip to get rid of these. Fortunately, three other libraries were able to benefit from these. So that's my disappointment, but also my huge sense of privilege to be able to come here today and to deliver this lecture. As you say, the parameters of pastoral persuasion, Pauline perspective, perhaps, possibly. Persuasion is a core tool of leadership in any sphere, I want to argue. Persuasion is a core tool of leadership in any sphere. And that persuasion can be verbal, or it can be physical. It can be intimidating, or it can be gentle. It can be threatening, or it can be affirming. Similarly, I want to suggest that one of the core tools of the pastor can be that of persuasion. And to the degree that a pastor is successful in persuading or influencing the lives of others, that pastor is by definition also a leader. In recent decades, or maybe only in recent years, this element of persuasion or influence is something that is much less readily accepted by congregations, but also, and maybe consequently, is only much less readily exercised by pastors. And this reluctance both to influence and be influenced is in no small measure a consequence, in the first instance, of the personal independence and self-reliance that characterize modernism. This reluctance is also, more recently, a product of the distrust and suspicion of authority that characterize postmodernism. And the reluctance is exemplified in the pastor who hesitates to challenge or confront and who avoids addressing areas of ethical ambiguity in the lives of those in the congregation. Unless, perhaps, and then only occasionally, from the safety of the pulpit rather than the one-to-one context. It is also exemplified in the congregation that suspects and therefore questions everything that is spoken by the pastor, resisting the notion of an external authority, whether it resides in a person, a tradition, or even a shared text. In his quite different cultural context, it is clear from his surviving letters that the Apostle Paul sought to persuade. In 2 Corinthians 5:11, he spells this out, saying, "Knowing the fear of the Lord, we try to persuade others." whether addressing churches or individuals, his letters present material that was intended in part to inform, but in large measure to instruct, encourage, or correct his readers. That is, to effect in his readers a change both in thinking and action. In addition to his written instructions, Paul also drew attention on a number of occasions to his own actions and lifestyle, with the intention of seeking to effect a change in behavior in the lives of others. The apostle could choose to frame his arguments and actions in either a threatening or non-threatening way. And in part dependent on his rhetorical skill, his communication might be to a greater or lesser degree effective. In this lecture, I would like us to consider two particular aspects of how Paul framed his attempts to persuade. That is, to effect in his readers a shaping, a reinforcing, or a change in their behavior, beliefs, or attitudes. It's important to note, however, that the scope of our inquiry is necessarily limited in a number of important ways due to the historical distance and the limitations posed by written communication, where access to the original author and recipients is now impossible. Without that access, either to communication from Paul's readers in response to his letters, or other evidence of the reaction of his readers, for the most part, we have little means of assessing the reception accorded by the original readers of the apostle's instructions or exhortation. Consequently, the extent to which we might regard Paul's attempts to persuade as successful or unsuccessful is very limited. It's true that some partial reconstruction of Paul's abilities to persuade might be attempted in those instances where we possess successive correspondence from Paul to a particular audience, and are able to gauge the extent to which either he is rehearsing the same material again in a second or third letter, in which case his exhortations may not have been entirely successful originally, or he is able to move on to quite different issues, in which case we might surmise that his teaching may have been successful and well received. Similarly, we could identify those instances where Paul apparently needs to refer back to teaching he presented on previous visits or in earlier correspondence, detailed accounts of which we no longer possess. But such reconstructions are at best tenuous, and judgments about the reception of Paul's correspondence may also include reflection on the existence and tone of successive correspondence to his recipients. And the Lucan record of the continuing welcome of the apostle as he returned to visit churches in Greece and Asia Minor. Indeed, in a very general sense, the history of reception of the letters in subsequent centuries by congregations in quite different locations, cultures, and contexts gives a measure of the range of responses that disparate communities have afforded to the apostles' tone and preaching. Although each of these lines of inquiry may be suggestive, none offers grounds on which to make a confident or substantiated reconstruction of the original reception of those letters. Rather, this lecture will focus on Paul's methods of persuasion rather than their effectiveness. Secondly, this lecture will also not endeavor to second guess Paul's motivations in seeking to persuade his readers. While I do not hold, others would, I do not hold that the recovery of a singular meaning in a text is necessarily and altogether futile, I do recognize that intentionality in an author or lecturer is often complex, and the recovery of that intentionality, what was behind, what were the motivations behind his letters, the recovery of that intentionality may be fraught with difficulty, given that it can be partially or fully concealed from or within an author's chosen wording. Indeed, if I were to reflect on my own motivations in writing this lecture, I would see them as complex and manifold, touching on personal, ecclesiastical, and scholarly issues, to name just a few. The task of this audience, you, many of whom are meeting me for the first time to second-guess my motivations, is all the harder. And by extension, our task of establishing the motivations of Paul as an ancient author who is not known and whose audience is not known to us is arguably impossible. Scholars are divided over whether it is appropriate to assume that Paul's motives are laudable and are clearly and transparently presented by him in his letters, or that those motives are malicious and are deliberately hidden from his audiences in order that his underlying manipulative agenda might be all the more effective, or indeed that there may be mixed motives. And you have to understand that the scholarly world is very much divided over this. There is a huge body of opinion that, from a postmodern perspective, wants to question the underlying motives behind Paul's letters, his desire to create uniform communities, a manipulative agenda in that regard. What I want to say is, I think that task of second-guessing Paul's motives is very hard to deduce accurately from the text itself. A way forward in this debate about motivations is hard to identify, in that scholars adopting the first approach may be viewed as naive and deluded. Those who say that Paul has laudable motives, and you can see those in the text, and scholars who take that view, and I would be inclined in that direction, that he has laudable motives, would be regarded as a proof indeed that to this day Paul continues to be a successful manipulator. He's deluded me, for example. Whilst those who adopt the second view are considered inherently suspicious, selectively reading portions of the Pauline corpus, assuming that the writer had an authoritarian agenda, which is at the least, I would say, anachronistic in the contemporary context of the apostles' own day and age. Despite the many attempts of scholars to reconstruct Paul's motivations, I want to argue that determining intentionality is at the least problematic, and that an individual's motives are normally highly complex, even fluctuating. And that said, it is not my presupposition in this lecture that all attempts to influence or persuade through rhetoric, indeed to manipulate or control, are necessarily objectionable and by definition oppressive, as some would hold. At the same time, I don't want to suggest that motives are unimportant, or that the motives of all leaders in the Bible were always and thoroughly unimpeachable. The sometimes questionable examples of King David and the Apostle Peter at Antioch, for example, are obvious cases in point where godly leaders at particular moments had questionable motives and incorrect and wrong actions as a result. Thirdly, I don't want to argue that any parameters of pastoral persuasion that we detect in the ministry of the Apostle Paul become a defined and generic set of parameters that are applicable in different contexts with different pastors and different congregations. It seems to me that a careful read of the Pauline letters reveals that his tone and his techniques of persuasion vary considerably, apparently in relation both to the seriousness of the situations that he was addressing, the urgency of the issue, and the nature of the relationship that existed between him and his readers. And fourthly, the content of Paul's message will also not be the focus here. His ethical teaching and his theological grounding of that ethical teaching are the legitimate focus of a quite separate study. Indeed, both scholars and pastors alike have tended to focus on this rather more accessible material, his theological foundations to his ethical principles and teaching. This lecture is restricted in large part, on the other hand, to a consideration of those methods of persuasion that can be detected in the letters, irrespective of their effectiveness and their content, and irrespective of Paul's underlying motivations, were we able to get them. I want to suggest that Paul adopts three principal tools of persuasion: rhetoric, appeal, and personal example. In this lecture, we shall first consider both Paul's attitude towards and his use of rhetoric. We shall then look at a number of passages where Paul seeks to persuade his readers by making an appeal to them. The third, and in my view, very important tool of persuasion, is the way in which he draws attention to and commends his own example and that of others. But time will prevent us from addressing this last aspect. However, in the background of this, it's my view that all three of these tools, the use of rhetoric, the use of personal appeal, and the presentation of his own example, are, as tools of persuasion, are in some way inimical to the postmodern context. The church today, the scholarly world today, reacts against the use of rhetoric, the use of personal appeal, and the use of presenting oneself as an example to be followed. First of all, Paul and the use of rhetoric. There is frequently either confusion or misunderstanding surrounding the term rhetoric. Not only is the term used by scholars with a wide range of meanings that are not always explicitly defined, but also, even in regular conversation, we might criticize a politician's speech. We might criticize a politician's speech as being mere rhetoric. Or we might praise that speech precisely on account of its rhetoric. Philip Kern lists four identifiable uses of the term, ranging from the general sense that rhetoric describes any verbal communication which has a strategic goal of persuading. Rhetoric is communication that seeks to persuade or influence an individual or an audience, to, on the other hand, the much more restricted sense of the highly developed grand style of Greco-Roman public discourse, as described in the ancient rhetorical handbooks. Since the 1960s, the development of rhetorical criticism as a hermeneutical method has resulted in a widely adopted distinction between rhetoric as a literary term and rhetoric as descriptive of the skills of the ancient rhetor or orator. And in this more recent sense, a hermeneutical tool, rhetoric describes the art of persuasion by the use of words and is not necessarily restricted to the context of oratory and public declamation. It's worth bearing that in mind. Rhetoric in that sense isn't restricted to the speech, the orator. Instead, it can be applied to analysis of narrative, of letters such as Paul's, and to other literary genres. Occasionally, and this is where it is unhelpful, one comes across a mixing of this literary use of the term rhetoric and the classical use of the term rhetoric used side by side, if not concurrently. And maybe the new genre of rhetorical commentaries that is emerging may occasionally reflect such a combining or confusing of these two types of rhetoric. Paul's own rhetorical skills, as well as his attitude towards the misuse of rhetoric in the proclamation of the gospel, have been a focus of scholarly attention in recent decades. How is it that Paul can, in the same correspondence, demonstrate an impressive ability to construct a persuasive argument, and yet, by his own estimation, and that of his first century opponents, he not only lacks rhetorical skill, but also rejects its use in the presentation of the gospel. And in this particular debate, the Corinthian correspondence has been a key focus and can be our starting point. It's widely recognized that there were internal divisions within the early Corinthian church. Paul's statements in 1 Corinthians 1 and 3, in which he refers to party allegiances focused around a number of apostolic individuals, together with those passages in the epistles in which he seeks to defend himself and his ministry, suggest that the apostle faced personal opposition from some significant quarters of that community. Although the presence of such parties is clear, the severity and extent of these divisions and their particular cause or focus are disputed by scholars. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, the first five verses, Paul raises the specter of his own lack of rhetorical abilities, and he explicitly rejects the use of rhetoric in the presentation of the gospel, saying, "My speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God." Furthermore, in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 6, Paul concedes that he was neither trained nor skilled in public speaking. And on the basis of these statements, it is assumed by many that a number of the Christians in the early Corinthian community were critical of Paul's skills in public declamation. And this view is reinforced by Paul's extended criticism of the Corinthians' preoccupation with worldly wisdom in 1 Corinthians chapters 1, 18 to the end of 4, where that wisdom is equated with the contemporary sophistry of the ancient public orators. Furthermore, it is often assumed that a number of the Corinthians made unfavorable comparisons between Apollos and Paul, largely on the basis of Luke's portrait of Apollos in Acts. It is inferred that this apostle from Alexandria had more accomplished rhetorical skills than Paul, and that these were especially attractive to a significant section of the Christian community in Corinth. The portrait of the Apostle Paul that predominates is thus one of a timid and a faltering public speaker who opposes the use of rhetoric in the presentation of the gospel. In contrast, the portrait of the Corinthian community, which predominates, is one in which many of its members regarded themselves as sophisticated critics of public oratory, who viewed Paul unfavorably in this regard. There are, however, it seems to me, certain problems with this reconstruction which are too often overlooked, and which result in either an inconsistent or a selective picture of Paul's attitude towards and abilities in the use of rhetoric. First, an assumption that the Apostle Paul lacked accomplishment as a public speaker is at odds with the portrait of him presented by Luke in Acts. Both in public and private contexts, the apostle is repeatedly presented as one who is able to deliver a highly skilled defense of himself and exposition of the gospel, and is clearly able to influence and persuade his audiences. Some of the Pauline speeches in Acts have been analyzed to be highly skilled instances of forensic rhetoric. It has been pointed out that Paul's speech in the Athenian Areopagus is a cleverly constructed piece of persuasion. Clearly, it can be argued that the writer of Acts may here be presenting an idealized portrait of the apostle, and that the speeches are largely editorial constructs, and you may be familiar with that kind of argument. If such a construction is correct, then the presentation of Paul in Acts in a more accomplished guise may simply be the fictional creation of the author of Acts, and many scholars would be comfortable with that. However, it is often overlooked that the argument which almost universally presents Apollos as contrastingly skilled in the use of rhetoric is based solely on the limited evidence found in Acts, Acts 18, 24 to 28, the contrasting picture of Apollos as proficient as a speaker derives from Acts, whereas the portrait of Paul in Acts is also of an accomplished and polished speaker. And it's on the basis of Acts 18, 24 to 28, that scholars would suppose that the focus of the Apollos party in the Corinthian church focuses on Apollos as a rhetor. Indeed, this assessment of Apollos lacks the supporting documentation of any examples of his rhetoric, whether in his own hand, as we have from Paul, or in Luke's hand, as we have of Paul. So, Luke presents the reader with a Paul who delivers persuasive speeches with fervor, and an Apollos who is described as eloquent, bold, accurate, and convincing as a speaker. And despite these two portraits in Acts, it is confidently held by scholars that Luke's portrait of Apollos, in contrast to his presentation of Paul, is accurate, rather than a stylized picture of the Alexandrian. And in this regard, the evidence in Acts is handled somewhat, in my view, inconsistently. And those who argue on the basis of Paul's own testimony that he was not a convincing public speaker have to dismiss the Lucan material regarding him, if not the rather more sparse Lucan material regarding Apollos. A second issue which is often overlooked is this. It should be noted that whether or not scholars are correct in assuming that Apollos had more accomplished skills than Paul with regard to public speaking. In the Corinthian correspondence, Paul does not oppose Apollos in any regard. In particular, he is not critical of Apollos' skills in public speaking. Nor does he even raise the issue of his fellow apostles' oratorical abilities. On the contrary, Paul's criticism is of those in the Corinthian church who were making such comparisons. Thus, it is not that we have a Paul who is somewhat ashamed of both his timidity in public and his all-too-apparent lack of polish in the art of public declamation, and is consequently embarrassed by the unfavorable comparison with the highly accomplished Apollos. Rather, I want to argue that we have a Paul who roundly rejects the use of rhetoric in the presentation of the gospel, who happens also to be the subject of negative criticism by the Corinthians, yet who, along with Luke, makes no public criticism of his fellow apostles' public speaking. And it's not that Paul is averse to offering clear criticism of apostolic figures where that's necessary. Where Paul believes one of his fellow apostles to be theologically misguided, as in the case of Peter recorded in Galatians 2, he roundly confronts the issue. Where the Corinthians were elevating skilled rhetoric, Paul roundly opposes them. And yet, apparently with some inconsistency, he raises no objection to the skill in public speaking of his fellow apostle Apollos. The third problem to be considered is that if Paul positions himself in an anti-rhetorical camp, how is it that his own letters reflect considerable skill in the art of framing a persuasive argument? Indeed, some scholars see in the hand of Paul a highly developed rhetorical art. And in this regard, the rhetoric displayed in the Pauline writings may appear to be more consistent with the Pauline speeches in Acts, but inconsistent with his own statements that the presentation of the gospel should not be occluded by reliance on rhetorical skills. Whilst it may be held that Paul was accomplished with the written word and lacked accomplishment with the spoken word, this does not resolve his apparent rejection of the use of wise and persuasive words in the presentation of the gospel, lest your faith might not rest on men's wisdom, but on God's power. 1 Corinthians 2. So, we have a situation where the evidence in Acts has to be either dismissed or read selectively in order for it to be regarded as uncontradictory of Paul's own view of his own abilities. Additionally, we need to consider the possibility that Paul's conviction that the use of rhetoric in the presentation of the gospel is inappropriate applies only to the spoken and not the written context. Conceivably, this stance is a defensive strategy adopted by one who lacked the ability to present himself well in an oral context, but recognized his skill with the written word. It is then for pragmatic reasons, rather than out of a genuine conviction, that Paul rejects the use of rhetoric in the presentation of the gospel, and it applies only in certain contexts. Those are the problems. One solution to these contradictions, which avoids either treating the evidence selectively or considering Paul to be inconsistent, is to define more narrowly what is meant by rhetoric. In particular, to avoid the situation where rhetoric is at some points used in a general sense, while at other points it is used in a more restricted sense. And it seems to me that an argument along these lines has been put forward by Michael Bullmore with regard to 1 Corinthians 2, 1-5. In particular, he proposes that the Corinthians wished to see in their leading figures public speakers who confidently declaimed with appropriate flourish according to the grand style as taught in the rhetorical handbooks of the time. In contrast, Paul's own conviction was that the presentation of the gospel should not be weakened by the use of such ornamentation. And this applied to both the oral and the written contexts. Indeed, he argues in 1 Corinthians 1:18 to 2:5 that God, in his wisdom, has provided a message of the cross, which in the eyes of the world is foolishness. Consequently, such a message of foolishness cannot effectively be presented when dressed up in wisdom, as understood by the sophists of the day. This did not mean to Paul, however, that the gospel should not be presented in a persuasive and compelling fashion. Both Paul's speeches in Acts and his letters include both carefully reasoned arguments and make persuasive appeals to the emotions of their respective audiences. Neither of these, however, complies with the identifiable trademarks of the trained rhetoricians. Although some scholars have argued that many of Paul's letters do reflect such a style, particularly with regard to the letter of Galatians, it has been convincingly argued by others that Paul does not employ the established art of rhetoric in his letters. Indeed, that the rules of the rhetorical handbooks only apply to the genre of public speeches and declamations, not to the genre of letters. And in this regard, Paul rejects the use of rhetoric as defined as that ornamented style adopted and fostered by the sophistic orators of the period and used exclusively in speeches. But he does not reject the skilled use of words when more broadly defined simply as the deliberate attempt to influence and persuade an audience, whether in speeches or in letters. Accordingly, Paul announces that his goal is indeed to persuade, as we read earlier on from 2 Corinthians 5. Since then we know what it is to fear the Lord, we try to persuade men. And he sets about the systematic, the organized, the deliberate demolition of arguments which are opposed to the truth. Again in 2 Corinthians 10, we demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. Where the goal of the trained orator was to entertain and impress, the goal of Paul is to present the gospel and persuade his hearers and readers. Now, if this view is correct, then we can consider that Luke's portrait of Paul's abilities as a public speaker may be more reliable than often assumed. That Paul's persuasive skills were consistent across both the written and spoken word, and that Paul's own apparent rejection of rhetoric is not an abandonment of all attempts to persuade people by means of words. Rather, it was possibly an inability, but certainly an avoidance of that type of oratorical flourish that the Corinthians so favored. The absence of any detail regarding the comparisons made by the Corinthians between Apollos and Paul means that we have no clear evidence, however, as to whether or not Apollos was accomplished in that stylized oratory which the Corinthians applauded. If Paul rejected the ancient rhetorical art, we need next to consider the ways in which Paul, in his letters, sought to persuade his audience without using the grand style of the orators. It is clear that he appeals to reason. We frequently see that he draws on biblical, supportive evidence, as well as arguments from society at large, in order to produce carefully reasoned arguments. And this kind of appeal, this kind of persuasion, appeals to the modernist in us, that holds that truth can be grasped by reason, and that our behavior and actions must be rational. Accordingly, these aspects of Pauline reasoning have been the bread and butter of scholars since the Enlightenment. I want to argue, though, that a close reading of the text shows that the apostle also, on occasion, appeals to the emotions of his readers and his listeners, variously using irony, sarcasm, shame, praise, or even flattery. These characteristics of his appeals are rather less acceptable to the modernist in us that presents such tools, or is prone to present such tools, as somewhat underhand. They belong to the armory of one who lacks a reasoned defense for a given position. These kind of appeals, we would often hold, are the penultimate resort before the application of force. These appeals to the emotions in the Pauline correspondence have, I want to argue, therefore been largely neglected among scholars. More recently, however, they have become the domain of a large number of scholars who use such evidence of emotive techniques as a ground for demonstrating the oppressive nature of Paul's attempts to manipulate his readers. And that's the ground that I want to reclaim. If the evangelical in me, the modernist in me also, is prone to saying that the reasoned argument is where we should stay, if I only do that, I allow the postmodernists to misuse the rest of the evidence and undermine the apostle whom I know from the text. The authority invested in Paul's position and as an apostle of God permits him simply to command his readers. Indeed, on occasion he does so. However, it seems to me that his preference is rather to make an appeal, and not uncommonly an appeal to the emotions of his readers. A frequent phrase is, "I appeal to you." Indeed, in his personal letter to Philemon, such an appeal is explicitly presented as in preference to a command, and it has clear emotional undertones. The context, you'll know, of Philemon is traditionally reconstructed as one in which Paul, somewhat reluctantly, apparently, is returning the runaway slave Onesimus to his rightful owner. Although the apostle's personal circumstances are such that he has significant need to keep the slave for his own support. If I read a few verses to you from Philemon, note the number of points in this appeal at which Paul draws on the emotive in his correspondence. Verse 8 to 14. "Although I am bold enough in Christ to command you to do your duty, yet I would rather appeal to you on the basis of love. And I, Paul, do this as an old man, and now also as a prisoner of Christ Jesus. I am appealing to you for my child, Onesimus, whose father I have become during my imprisonment. Formerly he was useless to you, But now he is indeed useful, both to you and to me. I am sending him, that is, my own heart, back to you. I wanted to keep him with me, so that he might be of service to me in your place during my imprisonment for the gospel. But I preferred to do nothing without your consent, in order that your good deeds might be voluntary and not something forced. Whew, voluntary, after you've heard that? Not something forced? That is an emotive appeal, a phenomenally emotive appeal, where he's piling one on top of another of aspects of drawing on the heart of Philemon for a response. Paul's preference is to do this by means of appeal and encouragement rather than laying down the law or condemnation. We might also note in the matter of raising financial support for the famine-stricken believers in Judea that Paul says to the Corinthians, I do not say this as a command, but I am testing the genuineness of your love against the earnestness of others. You'll recognize that as 2 Corinthians 8, where he's wanting to appeal to the Corinthians to give in comparison to the generosity of the Macedonians. I do not say this as a command, but I am testing the genuineness of your love against the earnestness of others. The manner in which Paul makes an appeal is said to be, by his, in his own words, 2 Corinthians 10, by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. But a cursory study of the Gospels, however, would reveal that some of Jesus' own appeals were not without their cutting edge. Certainly for Paul, appeal or urging can turn to pleading when he senses that the very salvation of his readers is at stake. Galatians 4, friends, I beg you, become as I am, for I also have become as you are. And when the unity of the body is at risk, also it becomes almost a begging. He also makes himself and his life vulnerable to the Corinthians and implores them to be similarly open to him. 2 Corinthians 6, 11 to 13, 7, 2 to 3. The nature of Paul's appeals to the Thessalonians is distinct, he suggests, from flattery. 1 Thessalonians 2, as you know, and as God is our witness, we never came with words of flattery. Although it seems to me that he comes very close to flattery in regard to the Corinthians with respect to the Jerusalem collection. 2 Corinthians 8, now, as you excel in everything, in faith, in utterance, in knowledge, in all earnestness, and in your love for us, see that you excel also in this gracious work. That's flattery, it would seem to me. Incidentally, this use of flattery is preceded by a statement which is intended to arouse in this proud and highly competitive community in Corinth the desire to outdo the acts of generosity fulfilled by another community, namely that of the Thessalonians, who are praised for having acted so generously, notwithstanding their comparative poverty. Titus is then commissioned to elicit a response of no less generosity from the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians 8, 1 to 6. Paul, therefore, uses the example of the Macedonian Christians as a means of goading the Corinthians into demonstrating generosity. But he also uses the example of the Corinthians equally to goad, in return, the Macedonians into generosity, 2 Corinthians 9:2. Paul reports that the Macedonians were neither forced nor cajoled into giving. But those Macedonians pleaded to be able to contribute to the collection for the Jerusalem church. And in so doing, he reports that they surprised even him. It's this portrait of the Macedonian churches which provides the basis from which Paul can appeal to the Corinthians to be no less generous. Clearly, such an appeal was not uncommon in Greco-Roman society, where the institution of patronage was highly competitive. Comparisons were very frequently made between patrons. No patron would like to be compared less favorably with another in terms of generosity. Note, however, that the goal of Paul's appeal is not to secure his own financial well-being, but to see that those in Jerusalem are adequately provided for in the face of famine, and that there is comparative economic equality. Jerusalem, after all, note, being the city which had been and would continue to be repeatedly unwelcoming towards Paul, as Luke records in Acts. Thus, this is not a self-serving appeal, and many of the postmodern commentators would argue that Paul's use of manipulation is self-serving. And patronage in ancient Mediterranean society was largely self-serving. Nor does Paul cite his own example. Rather, he highlights the Macedonians, and more significantly, Jesus himself. Though he was rich, yet for your sakes, our sakes, he became poor. Thus, in this instance, he uses appeal and advice rather than command. And this is all intended to appeal to the Corinthians' sense of personal honor and pride. Paul has expressed confidence that the Corinthians will be obliging, and he does not want to be embarrassed at his description being found to be unworthy. He accordingly applies pressure. 2 Corinthians 9:4. If some Macedonians come with me and find that you are not ready, we would be humiliated, to say nothing of you in this undertaking. On occasion, Paul is happy to disclose to the Corinthians the agenda that lies behind his appeals. He points out in 2 Corinthians that his earlier letter had the intended goal of causing them sorrow that would lead ultimately to repentance, 2 Corinthians 7, 8-13. And in the process, the Corinthians had indeed been sorrowful. And in that regard, we may well deem that Paul's communication had been successful. But Paul's joy is in the outcome, namely forgiveness. As well as appealing to the loyalty of his readers, Paul also on occasion appeals to their sense of honor, specifically by shaming them into more appropriate behavior. In this regard, Paul is at odds with the established practices of the trained orators of his day. To shame those whom you wanted to impress could hardly be considered an effective tool in a society where personal honor was so highly valued. It is true that shame was frequently employed in forensic speeches, but in those instances the goal was not to win over those who were being shamed, but rather to humiliate them as one's opponents and to incite a jury against the shamed party. If you sought to win the support of a particular segment of your listeners, these you would be advised not to shame. In contrast, Paul adopts sarcasm in addressing the Corinthians that is intended to highlight the ridiculous nature of the stance that they are sometimes taking. 1 Corinthians 6, in regard to those who seek to settle their civil litigation against a fellow brother in public, he poses the question as to whether this congregation, which so prides itself on the display of wisdom, really lacks anyone in the congregation who is wise enough to adjudicate in such petty lawsuits, 1 Corinthians 6, verse 5. And this is all the more pointed when it is noted that Paul considers even the least esteemed, according to their own standards, that is, in the church, are actually appropriately qualified to judge angels, and therefore also, presumably, to adjudicate in these minor matters of law that they have to take outside the church. Accordingly, he specifically points out in chapter 6, verse 5, I say this in order to shame you. In contrast, Paul, after a passage of great irony in chapter 4, verses 8 to 13, points out for the benefit of his readers that his aim on that occasion is not to shame them, verse 14, but to warn them as a father warns that his children. So, Paul does not conceal his desire to persuade. Indeed, to suggest that he sought to manipulate by stealth is to ignore the number of times in which he makes plain to his audience both the goal and the method of his exhortations. Paul also makes an emotional appeal to the Galatians. In particular, he reminds the Galatians of their loyalty to him when he first preached the gospel to them. Indeed, their personal care for him whilst he suffered from some medical ailment that we know not of. Their commitment to him as their apostle now appears to have been transferred to a group of infiltrators who do not have their best wishes at heart. The appeal to the Galatians at this point is clearly an emotional one, intended to arouse sympathy and remind them of the honour of their devotion to him. And this appeal to the better nature of the Galatians is contrasted with the rather more blunt appeal by Paul when he repeatedly shames them with somewhat vituperative language. Chapter 1, verse 6, I am so astonished that you are so quickly deserting him who called you in the grace of Christ and turning to a different gospel. Or chapter 3, verse 1, oh foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you? Or chapter 5, verse 12, I wish those who unsettle you would mutilate themselves. Paul's message is unalterable, regardless of what suffering this entails for him. Those who are in the wrong can display this by altering their message so as to avoid persecution. Equally, Paul is not seeking to gain approval from men, chapter 1, verse 10, in contrast to some of the so-called apostles who have infiltrated the Corinthian church. So we have seen examples of forceful appeals made by Paul to two of the notoriously problem churches with which he corresponds. The apostle is also prepared, however, to apply a similar measure of moral obligation in his personal correspondence, for example, to Philemon, with regard to the issue concerning Onesimus. In that instance, as we saw, he used the cultural code of reciprocity. Paul's been generous to Philemon and is now calling in Philemon's debt by urging that he follow Paul's appeal concerning Onesimus. Here is an instance where Paul does make use of the principle of patronage. Whereas with regard to the Corinthians, he deliberately distanced himself from that. A couple of concluding comments. It seems to me that we can say that Paul's goal is clearly to persuade. Unpopular though that might be today. He does this openly, yet there are parameters. He avoids the use of those rhetorical techniques that would cause his audience to be impressed by him as an individual, and so detract from his chief goal, namely that people respond appropriately to the gospel. His goal is unashamedly to influence. Paul's commitment to this goal drives him to be bold, not apologetic, in the presentation of his message. Flattery and praise alone could win many friends, but may not result in changed lives. Flowery rhetoric and display could impress many, but may not result in changed lives. Paul's goal was to win people for Christ rather than merely to win their friendship. Indeed, he recognizes that much of his message may indeed succeed in creating enemies, Galatians and 2 Corinthians in particular. He can offer appeals from the heart and then can say, we will be ready to punish any act of disobedience once your obedience is complete, 2 Corinthians 10:6. To Philemon, he appeals on the basis of love. It's clear that Paul writes at different times and in different contexts with varying amounts of heat or fervor. And he even highlights instances where he's not entirely happy with his tone, Galatians 4 and 1 Corinthians 4. And so much of that, as a set of parameters of pastoral persuasion, are at odds with what is acceptable in our own society today. Thank you.